image. That's how they're handled across the country. So if you go, do a good job. And if you stay, do a good job here, so you can help people to go.
Positive, so they have the genetic information to produce that enzyme.
we can distinguish it from Diophanes' negative rods. They're all going to be short, single-cell, gram-negative rods. And Enterobacteriaceae, the AC is a family ending, and the Enterobacteriaceae family are E. coli organisms, okay? E. coli, Salmonella organisms, Shigella organisms, okay? So those organisms are all in that family. In fact, it can be argued, although we've since gone beyond that in microbiology, but we can argue the classification of it based on the use of genetic information as opposed to phenotypic information as to what it looked like. So when these were identified and broken into genus and species in the 1880s and 1890s, when we finished up the helicophosphates and we found this organism, that organism, and so on, we began to name them with genus and species. Now what we would do it, we would find that many of these organisms that we put in completely different genera are probably subspecies of each other. And the differences are not that great. Okay, but nonetheless, that's how we do it. So we keep them, So the Enterobacteriaceae family members are a very, very close family. Okay? A lot of inbreeding in this family. But anyway, so we have E. coli, Salmonella, Shigella organisms in the Enterobacteriaceae family. Fastidious means difficult to grow. We have to do something special to get them to grow. Picky eaters are fastidious. Haemophilus, the word hemo-liking, grows on red blood cells, haemophilus. Okay? And in fact, it generally needs to have some extra growth factors added. Oftentimes we actually have to add heme to it because it can't seem to easily get the oxygen free from the air that's distilled from hemoglobin. And so we have Haemophilus legionella organism. We have heard of Legionnaire's disease, which is a viral trap problem we'll talk about later. Bordetella, that causes whooping cough. The other ones aren't too common. Brucella and Klebsiella, not too common, but they're on that group of rod-shaped organisms. Okay. And the anaerobes there, these are Bacteroides organisms. Anaerobes grow without oxygen. And they cause infections in areas of the body that don't have a lot of oxygen. And they're sort of microbe environments. And you would not expect all of the areas that they actually have anaerobic conditions to be anaerobic. For example, you would have anaerobic conditions in the lung if you have a collapsed lung. You've probably all heard of a problem where you pull the oxygen wisdom teeth and you get something called a dry socket. Okay? Probably 2/3 of people have had their wisdom teeth pulled. Who's had their wisdom teeth? Right? You may have heard of an adverse effect called a dry socket. And that's an anaerobic infection. You get that hole, and down in the hole, that's where the organism is growing. Okay? So there are anaerobic conditions. In fact, Bacteroides are common, found in the intestinal tract. And so if something's wrong in the GI tract, or it's out of the GI tract because of peritonitis or something like that, Bacteroides can do that. Vibrio, as in Vibrio cholera, the organism causes cholera. And we'll talk about that a little later, the GI tract problem. Campylobacter, it's also the cause of the diarrhea and the problem we'll talk about. You'll remember that later when we talk about a bloody diarrhea, which is a little bit unusual. So all of those organisms across the top there are gram-negative organisms that are rods. And they are all individual cells. No change or anything like that. So in essence, if you look at them in the microscope and you put gram-negative on them, that's what they would all look the same. Then we have gram-negative organisms that are cockle-shaped. There's not too many of those. Bramella and Neisseria. Neisseria as in Neisseria gonorrhoeae, which we talked about, or Neisseria meningitidis, which we talked about. And we'll talk more about them later, of course, but just mention them already. Bramella, we haven't talked about, that causes an eye infection. Okay? And we know that, of course, most gram-positives can cause eye infections because of lysozyme. But here we have the gram-negative organism, and remember, the gram-negative doesn't have the murine exposed, it's got this lipid layer, and it's harder for lysozyme to really do anything to those. So they're basically not affected by lysozyme, even though their murine layer would be affected if you can get it there. But usually you can't get the drug to the layer. The ones on the far right there, the cockle-shaped arrows, are not very common at all. Then we go down to frauds. Now they've got an oddity here in this that is a mistake. We'll call it an oddity. But they have some strange things in this second block here. We can go through it. Branching kind of phenomena is associated with fungus-like bacteria, okay, or fungal organisms. They're really close. We'll follow these words like fungal organisms, but they're prokaryotic cells inside, so they're sort of fungal. So they're called branching. Leucardia, actinomycetes, those organisms are associated with some human diseases that we'll talk a little bit about. Gram-positive rods can often cause the production of spores. And spores are something that is important relative to the survival of the organism, and we'll talk about those even today. And it can be a virulence factor in the sense that it allows the organism to survive and then germinate in your body and cause disease. Clostridia organisms, like Clostridia tetany, or Clostridia perfringens, the organism that causes gas gangrene. Clostridia tetany obviously causes tetanus. Spores are associated with those organisms. Bacillus organisms often are associated with spore production as well. Bacillus subtilis is not a mild food poisoning at best, but it's commonly a contaminant in the lab. So if we're not doing good infection control someplace, the spores of that organism are the one early ones that are indicator organisms that you've got a problem, you don't know about that. That is, you've got a contamination problem, hasn't resulted in any disease yet, but you've got a break in control. Bacillus organisms also have anthrax, and we've got bacillus anthracis, the organism causes anthrax, and we've probably heard of biological weapons associated with anthrax and spores. And we'll talk about that today as well. One of the key mistakes they made on this is they included acid fats. Obviously, acid fats, mycobacterium organisms, are rod-shaped, yes, but they are not gram-positive organisms. Mistake in the graph, which is something that we often see in vegetables. Not perfect. We also have some word tests. We have catalase test. Catalase is a way of breaking down hydrogen peroxide. So it protects the organism against environmental hydrogen peroxide. And again, it's an enzyme, and therefore there's a piece of genetic information that is common to a particular group of organisms, and therefore can be used for identification purposes. Carinobacterium, as in Carinobacterium diphtheriae, the organism that causes diphtheria, is a gram-positive rod. Listeria is an agent of food poisoning. It's actually called Listeria monocytogenes. Monocytogenes. Genes referring to genesis, beginning, founding, and monocyte is a type of cell. So this organism actually invades our macrophage population, which is an unusual situation, particularly in the case of a food poisoning mechanism. So we'll talk about that in the GI tract problem. There is a gram reaction and morphology. Lactobacillus organisms, for the most part, are not causing any kind of disease. They're the ones that are involved in making cheeses. They're the ones involved in a step of making wine better. They can have a lactic fermentation. Takes the first step of making wine is an alcoholic fermentation with yeast organisms, and the second stage is a bacterial process, and that's not a lactic, so it makes the wine taste a little bit better. So lactobacillus are involved in that. Wine making, cheese making, things like that. Cockle-shaped organisms that are gram-positive. It looks on the right-hand side, again, under the catalase category. We have separation between staph organisms and strep organisms based on catalase, and that's an important observation. Again, there's nothing significant of over-significance relative to virulence, that's breakdown, hydrogen peroxide is present. But it's used in the key lab step to separate staphylococcus organisms from streptococcus organisms. And staphylococcus are grape-like clusters of cockle-shaped organisms. Streptococcus are chains of gram-positive cockle organisms. and Staph aucoplex staph aureus. You've heard of MRSA, methicillin-resistant staph aureus. So the staph aureus micrococcus, not so much in the way of human diseases there. But we moved to the strep, of course, we've got strep pyogenes and streptococcus pneumoniae and some other organs in that group. So basically, this is just a little framework linking together bits of information relative to the shape of the organism and their staining characteristics. Most often, gram-positive, gram-negative, we've got the one little anomaly there, that's the fact. And it's that little kind of bits of information that are important in the early steps of what drugs we use. Because obviously, some drugs are not to work on all organisms. And gram-positives are the easiest to hit, particularly with the cell wall surface inhibitor, but even with other drugs, because you can get through that murine layer. Whereas the gram-negatives is a little harder. So many drugs are narrow spectrum, meaning they work only with gram-positive. Fewer drugs are broad spectrum, meaning they work equally well with gram-positive and gram-negatives. And then something like an organism that affects acid fast, there's only a handful of those antimicrobial agents that affect acid fast. So that's just something, again, nothing that I'm going to have you memorize, but it is something that you will need to know. But not for this class. We're talking about mycoplasma, and the cell is 3 hours, 10 hours a day, don't have a cell wall. And the cell wall is stabilized by the presence of cholesterol, even though bacterial cells can't make cholesterol. They are certainly capable of stealing it, and we talked about the fact that they're stealing it. Give a little case study to plant the significant differences between mycoplasma and some other organisms in a clinical setting. We'll give a little case study. We have George. We always pick on poor George. I don't know if there's anybody who's in George here. I'm not picking on anybody with a picture. So George has got a cough. And it's a non-productive cough, meaning that when he coughs, he doesn't bring anything up. And so it's sort of a dry, non-productive cough. Sort of like that. And that was a productive one, drop something up. So if you bring something up, then it's basically you stop coughing for a while because the mucus that you brought up, you swallow, and you're okay. On the other hand, the dry productive cough is the result of an irritant in the lung someplace, and you keep on coughing. It's like a smoker's cough. So this guy. That sort of thing. And it's constant. And you drive everybody around you crazy because you're constantly coughing. And you never get satisfied with the cough because you never really bring anything up. So he has this dry, non-productive cough. He has a mild fever, 101, something like that. It comes and goes, not continuous. And that's it. Over the next several weeks of coughing like this, maybe as much as a month, he gradually gets to the point where he starts feeling tired. And what's happening is, on the inside of his lung, the organism is growing on the alveolar surface, and it is phospholipids in its membranes are triggering T-cell lymphocytes to divide. So it's a T-cell lymphocyte mitogen. T-cell mitogen. Mitogen is something that triggers a cell to divide. Mitogenic. Mitosis. So a T-cell mitogen is what this organism is. And so it's stimulating T-cells in the area of the alveolar lining to divide, and the alveolar lining is gradually getting thicker and thicker. Normally one cell thick, it becomes 2 in spots, or 3 in spots, and so on. And this thicker alveolar wall is not providing as much oxygen exchange. That's why George is starting to get slowly getting tired. So George finally, his wife tells him, you're driving me crazy with this cough, go get it looked at. He goes to the doctor and complains that he has this cough, and the doctor listens to his lungs a little bit and says, yeah, okay, so we'll give you an antibiotic. And they usually pick the drug of choice, typically, for many other of the organisms that are found in the lung. Streptococcus organisms, Streptococcus pneumoniae, Haemophilus influenzae, dysenteries. It's going to be a broad spectrum agent. So they put them on ampicillin or maybe a cephalosporin like Keflex or Keflin that they've been injecting with people in the world. And of course, that, what do you think that does to mycoplasma? Nothing. Okay. So he's gone to the doctor and he's coughing a little bit. So he waits for a couple of weeks. Now he's sick for maybe 6 weeks. And he goes back in. And the doctor says, well, I don't know what it is here, but you start hearing some rustling, a vibration in your lung. We call it rails. And you might hear it as you breathe in, inspiratory rails. As you breathe in, you sort of open up the sacs a little bit, you sort of collapse a little bit, and you force air into it, the diaphragm pulls the vacuum down, and it sort of opens up the lung a little bit. And then when you exhale, to creep back in. You hear this creaking sound. It's called it rails. So the doctor says, gee, Willie, I don't know what this is. Let's do an x-ray. And on the x-ray, the whole lung is all inflamed. And the doctor gets a little mad at himself, but they take it out of the drug. George, why didn't you come in here earlier? We've got to treat this now. You should have been here earlier. Of course, George was there earlier. But it's all throughout the lung. A typical bacterial infection, like Streptococcus pneumoniae or Haemophilus influenzae, if a person is upright walking around, the organism drains to the bottoms of the lung, the tips of the lung. We call it lobar, the tips of the lobes of the lung. And that's where you see the inflammation on that chest x-ray. Because what you're reading on a chest x-ray is not microorganisms, but inflammation. When you're reading the patient's immune response, the x-rays don't allow you to see critters, right? Microscope. So what you're seeing is inflammation. And the inflammation typically at the tips of the lungs for Streptococcus pneumoniae, Haemophilus influenzae, those are lobar pneumonia. This is unusual. It's throughout the lung because it's not really purely an infection. It's a stimulation of T cells in the body. Okay? And this is spread throughout the lung. And it's called interstitial because it's in between the alveolar layer. It's interstitial, not alveolar, not in the sac, but in the wall of the cell. So he sees there's a big problem and puts him on a particular drug. It's a protein synthesis inhibitor. It works quite well with mycoplasma. I mean, mycoplasma doesn't have any way of protecting itself. Things get right in easily if you use the right drug. But obviously, protein cell wall synthesis inhibitors have no effect. So he uses a protein synthesis inhibitor, very effective, kills off the organism in 2 weeks. So now he's been sick for 8 weeks, but he's not done yet. He's not done yet because parts of the organism are still, you know, they're dead, but they're floating around, and it's the parts of the organism that are stimulating T cells to divide. So as long as those parts are there, the stimulation continues. Now you're not producing more organisms, but you've got to somehow eventually phagocytize and get rid of all those parts. That takes time. In fact, maybe another 6 weeks. So he was sick, coughing, for 12 weeks, 14 weeks. You know, we're talking months here, 3 months or more. So the course of the disease is a very long course of the disease. Unlike bacterial pneumonia, where generally, you either recover in 2 or 3 weeks or you die. Okay, so you get the choices there. But you're not going to have bacterial pneumonia for 3 months. Not going to happen. So the course of the disease is unusual for most bacterial organisms. And it generally is not fatal. I think there's one case on record in which a woman is destitute of it indicates that she died of mycoplasma pneumonia, but that's not. Maybe they misdiagnosed that, or she had something else or something. So it's not considered to be a fatal process, but it is a probably need to treat. It generally occurs in clusters, so we have kids at a daycare center, children are susceptible, people in an office place, people will all get, sometimes it's associated with the so-called sick building. Obviously it's not a sick building, it's the people in the building who are sick, but it spreads within an office complex. So it's part of our differential diagnosis of a sick building, because we might have to get this, because it's not really a building problem, it's the people spreading to each other. Dorms would be another good place. College students cluster together. And you get this cough, and it just doesn't go away. It's smoker's cough. That's an indication it's mycoplasma. So the fact that it's biology, how it's constructed, the fact that it doesn't have a cell wall, meaning certain drugs won't work, the fact that it has phospholipids that stimulate T cells in the body, that has an impact on the pathology. So most organisms that cause pneumonia have capsules. Most organisms that cause lung infections have capsules. They also cause meningitis. But then there's the odd ones. The odd ones are truly odd. There's something different about them. That would be like acid fast, for the local organism, or mycoplasma. Remember, mycobacterium and mycoplasma are two entities. One final note about mycoplasma. I was at the early stages of the AIDS epidemic. I was at an international meeting and listening to Guy Montagne. Guy Montagne is one of the co-discoverers of HIV, he's from Pasteur Institute. And his main focus of his talk at that point was he was concerned about HIV-positive patients with mycoplasma infections. Now, we'll learn more about HIV now. We have already some ideas. It's a virus invades helper T cells, a subcategory of a lymphocyte. And it integrates this information into the genome of that cell. And when it's integrated, it's sort of quiet. Eventually, that cell gets activated to divide, and as it does, it activates the replication of the virus. If it doesn't get a signal to divide, then that activation of the virus is at a lower level. Along comes a T cell mitogen, and it triggers all of these cells to divide without regard to their normal activation. Their normal activation is because an antigen for that particular T cell comes along and it's pulled into the immune response. So usually the activation of the T cell is antigen dependent. So here is an antigen independent activation, that is, it's a T cell mitogen. So what happens in the AIDS patient then is that many of their T cells, not having seen their antigen, but just being there and exposed to mycoplasma, are triggered to divide. That decreases the period of time the person goes from HIV positive status to full blown AIDS with the destruction of their immune response. Shortens the time. That can't be good. Okay? So therefore, we need to protect the patients against this kind of infection and recognize it as a possibility early on and treat it aggressively before it stimulates all the T cells in the body. So a T cell might, by the way, there are other microorganisms that can stimulate cells that divide. We'll talk later about Epstein-Barr virus, an organism that causes mononucleosis. That's a B cell mitogen. It stimulates B cells that divide. So it's not unusual to have microorganisms triggering our cells to divide independent of an antigen-driven system. Protoplast versus spheroplast. This is sort of a recurrent argument that occurs. And it goes through cycles of about 10 years. So you either will be hearing one shortly or you'll hear one eventually. And just so that you have some background, some grounding in the discussion. If we grow a microorganism in the presence of a cell wall synthesis inhibitor, in a media that's osmotically balanced, we can strip away the cell wall and the lysis will not occur. Remember, penicillin unravels the urine layer, like layers of an onion, exposing the membrane to osmotic lysis. And even though penicillin doesn't cause the direct lysis of the cell, we still categorize it as a bactericidal agent that kills organisms. But it does it in this derived manner, not directly, but derived. So if you grow the organism in a balanced solution, when you strip away the cell wall, the osmotic balance allows no lysis to occur. So we can do this in the laboratory. And if it's a gram-positive organism, that's that membrane critter that we've got, it still has the genetic information to make a cell wall, but it's in the presence of penicillin, so it's not. So it divides and divides and divides, and it grows. As long as everything is kept fine, it's not going to be hurt by the penicillin. It becomes a protoplast. So gram-positives become protoplasts. Gram-negatives in the same situation, with a broad spectrum cell wall synthesis inhibitor in a balanced solution, still retain little bits and pieces of the inner part of the membrane there attached. So the inner part of the cell wall is there, attached to the membrane, just parts of it. So it's called a spheroplast. Gram-positive protoplast, no membrane attached, no cell wall attached to the membrane. Spheroplast, little bits and pieces of the cell wall still attached to the cell membrane. Well, that's a laboratory finding. That's a little experiment that one might want to do. But occasionally, people accredit micro-niche environments that provide the necessary balanced osmotic conditions in a patient. And they think that this is a mechanism by which organisms are refractory, they're resistant to treatment. So they're built micro-niche environments, so they're in your body someplace. And even though you're treating with the right drug, and you kill off all the susceptible ones, there are some that sort of survive without a cell wall until you put the patient off the antibiotics and now comes back full-blown again. The likelihood of this occurring is very remote. And after someone comes up with the idea, there's 19 papers to refute it, and then it disappears again. But then it comes back again, and we go through this cycle. So theoretically, one might posit that that might happen. But in a practical sense, in a patient, we don't think it really happens. We think that the obvious things are going on. That is, main reason for antimicrobial treatment failure, patient noncompliance. Number one reason. Number two reason, you could have subpopulations of the organism, most of which might be susceptible to, let's say, penicillin or something, whatever you're using, and a subpopulation of the same organism, mixed culture kind of thing, but the same organism, has enough resistance to survive the level of treatment to kill off everybody else. So it recurs. It wasn't hidden away as a protoplast or spheroplast. It had inherent resistances that the other ones didn't have, and you just selected for the resistance in the patient. That's the number two reasonable idea. Okay? So those are, when you hear hooves, think of a horse, those are horses. This would be a zebra. A circus was in town, and the zebra got loose. That's not a common event. Theoretically possible, yes, but not too likely in the missionary, right? So, protoplast, spheroplast, you should know what the words mean, but also recognize that it's probably going to come up in some discussion someplace, and you'll now know that it's probably not very clinically relevant to the reading of the event. Cytoplasmic structures. Down in the membrane, now on the inside. Earlier we showed a gram-positive rod that was just about ready to divide. We showed the techoic acids on the outside, so it's a long rod. And you could see the two areas where the DNA was, the two nuclear bodies. It's not membrane bound, but that's where it is. So we put a coat around it. It's not a structure in the same way that other things were structured. But the DNA is there, it's someplace. In some places it is, it's called the nuclear body. Ribosomes. Ribosomes, we mentioned, important for protein synthesis, obviously. We meant that in biochemistry. It's important to remember that bacterial ribosomes are structurally different than human cell ribosomes, and that provides the basis of selective toxicity of a category of drugs known as protein synthesis inhibitors. So, cell wall synthesis inhibitors, we talked about. Protein synthesis inhibitors, another category of antimicrobial drugs. And again, most protein synthesis inhibitors are broad spectrum. Their spectrum of action is not dependent upon attacking a murine layer or something like that. But there is some problems with some structures that they can't get into gram-negative organisms as well as they get into gram-positive organisms. Now you did notice that we talked about the gram-negative, we have this pore structure. Many of the drugs can go through that. some of them can't get through it. Okay, so there are some differences between drugs relative to gram-positive and gram-negative, and that influences whether they get to the site or not. But once they're at the site, they'll work equally well. Protein synthesizers interfere with the making of protein. Commonly, they bind to a protein of the ribosome and then interfere with the translation problem, the translation of messenger RNA. Cytoplasmic granules. You recall that we said that a characteristic of prokaryotic organisms is that they do not have organelles. They do not have lipid-lined substructures. Eukaryotic cells have them, you have them. Bacterial cells, prokaryotic cells don't have them. So they don't have closets. No place to put it in. Okay. So everything must be in the cytoplasm. But rather than having everything just sort of loosely floating around, the cell does it organizes by making a polymer. Okay. So we'll have glycogen for glucose. We'll have polyphosphates for sourcing phosphate, inorganic phosphate. One of the compounds that was discovered, which we couldn't figure out what it did, we figured it was storing something, but we couldn't figure out what it was storing for a long while, and that is polybeta-hydroxybutyrate. Polybeta-hydroxybutyrate. Polybeta-hydroxybutyrate, unique to bacteria, not found anywhere else in the world, according to it, only in bacterial cells. What it did, they couldn't figure out. Big puzzle for quite a while. Then they finally sort of sitting around, probably having a beer or a glass of wine or something, saying, you know, there's nothing in the structure of a carbon. I don't know what in the world is something. Carbon. Yes, that's what it is. It's a source of carbon. It's just a branching carbon structure. And polybeta hydroxybutyrate, carbon source. It was right there in front of us all the time. We just didn't have our eyes open. Doing. All it is carbon. Ah, it's providing carbon. Endospores. Endo meaning inside, spores, which is this specialized bacterial cell. You can see a picture of it. Bacterial spores are the only example of a specialized prokaryotic cell. Only example of a specialized prokaryotic cell. Anybody name a specialized eukaryotic cell? The first one is always public from that. Specialized eukaryotic cell. You're using one right now, I hope. Yes, okay. Brain tissue, brain cells, and of course cardiac tissue, liver cells, so on throughout the body, epithelial cells. Osteoclasts, everything. Okay? They're all specialized cells in your body. You have 10 trillion cells, and there's lots and lots of specialized variety. Bacterial world, not so much. Okay? Most bacteria can only produce one kind of cell. We call that, in contrast to the other kinds, that's called a vegetative cell. And a vegetative cell, not a vegetable, but a vegetative cell, you can see that it begins with a single cell in there, and then it's moving around and it divides into two by binary fission, meaning it's equal sizes. Binary fission is another characteristic of prokaryotic organisms. And from binary fission, it forms two bacterial cells, and then they divide into two more, and so on and so on. Well, some organisms, largely gram-positive rods, more specifically in the genus, or genera there, of Bacillus and Clostridium. We saw those earlier this morning. And so we have Bacillus subtilis, Bacillus anthracis, Clostridia botulinum, the botulism, Clostridia tetanus, and others. So when you see Clostridia, you'll know that spores are part of the process. And part of the problem. And they can be those components of some of these Clostridial organisms. So let's see what happens. The cell produces an inner structure, as you can see here. It gradually separates itself from the rest of the cell. forming membranes, eventually a spore coat. And while it's still inside there, you can see it, the staining procedures, changing some light conditions, it reflects light differently than cytoplasm. Earlier investigators called it a refractile body, because it reflected light differently. Eventually it breaks loose from the cell that it's in, and it's no longer an endospore, it becomes a free spore. And the free spore may eventually germinate and become a bacterial cell. Notice that one bacterial cell can produce one spore, and one spore produces one bacterial cell. This is not a reproductive cycle. Now, in contrast, the spore term is used in another setting, and that is, it describes a specialized cell for fungal organisms. So a fungal organism can produce a fungal spore. Now, fungal organisms are eukaryotic cells. And so it's going to look differently. We're not going to see binary fission when it's dividing. A lot of things are going to be different because fungal organisms are eukaryotic cells. But in terms of the spores, one fungal organism can produce hundreds of spores. It is part of a reproductive cycle. Now, bacterial spores are designed to be resistant to a variety of physical characteristics, and that's their claim to fame, resistance. They can survive very harsh environments. Fungal spores, no. Their mechanism of survival is to produce many, many, many offspring and hope that some make it. Okay. Different strategies for survival of that species. So we have the special spore characteristics. So let's take a look at it. We have a spore coat. So we have a spore coat. Outside there, you see that spore coat. The spore coat is a cysteine-rich structure. Cysteine. Disulfide bond. What does that mean? Last one, we're going to here. That cysteine-rich spore coat creates like a knight in shining armor kind of thing. You know, the armor, the mail, they call it. It's just sort of a web of steel. That's what surrounds this spore, cysteine-rich spore coat. And that protects it against the following kinds of environmental conditions. Radiation. So it can survive X-radiation. Spores can survive nuclear blast as long as they're not destroyed by the thermal effects. So if they're not right around zero, but they're someplace away and radiation is around, they can survive the radiation. You can't survive it. It's horrible. Spores can survive extremes of pH, acid conditions or alkali conditions. Bacterial cells, vegetative cells cannot do that. Your cells cannot do that. Bacterial cells can survive organic solvents. So the spores can survive acetone, alcohol. That doesn't affect them. Obviously, that would destroy mediate the proteins and destroy some of the other kinds of life forms. So spores are able to survive many different environmental conditions because of the cysteine-rich spore coat. Now they have another characteristic which is associated with a spore-specific compound. And the spore-specific compound is the calcium salt of dipropionic acid. Calcium salt of dipropionic acid. Now, dipropionic acid dehydrates the spore. And the low water concentration of the spore protects it against boiling. A little bit of chemistry for you. When we boil something that's alive, how does heat of boiling, 100 degrees centigrade, how does that do damage to a cell, normally? No, it doesn't vaporize it. Boiling doesn't vaporize it.
Denatures protein.
Okay? So, it denatures a protein, and the denature protein means an altered tertiary structure, the arrangement of its shape. So, for a protein to be functional, like an enzyme or even structural proteins, they have to have certain shapes. We're not breaking the bonds of the atoms to each other, but we are taking the shape away from them. And by altering the shape, for example, an enzyme is no longer active. Okay? Now, you thought that was a one-step procedure, but it isn't. Because what happens is that when you shape it out like that, if you cool it down under the right conditions, it will reshape. It will renature. It will become active again. Heated, it becomes denatured, but it's not permanent. It becomes renatured. The difference is the presence of water. Okay. So when water is present, the hydroxyl groups,
do you think she's like one of those politicians in the president's speech who's sitting there?
Anyway, the denaturing process, when you stretch it out, you're obviously going to make some changes in some hydrogen bonding, and so there'll be some dangling things there in terms of structures. You're not breaking them on, but you're sort of breaking some of the hydrogen bondings. And you do that, and hydroxyl groups and hydrogen groups from the water will stick into those structures, so when it cools down, it's then blocked from being active again. Okay? So water is essential to maintain the permanence of the denaturing process. Without water, it will renature and become active again. So the low water concentration of the spore, because of the presence of a spore-specific compound, the calcium salt of nitroglycerinic acid, results in the ability of the organism to survive living. Which do you think is more effective? 100% alcohol, ethanol, or 70% ethanol in terms of denaturing proteins? 70%. So we talk about hand washing and things like that. You know, H1N1, people talk about hand washing. You know, those solutions, the little gels or whatever you use there, look at them, they're about 65% or so alcohol. They drop below 65% or below 50% and not effective. 65 is fine. Okay? Because that means that it's 35% something else. And that something else needs to be water. So we have now another characteristic of resistance. Now I said that that was a spore-specific product, the calcium salt of nitroglycerinic acid. In the process of sporulation, cell goes into the genome and it pulls out some things and activates them that are only activated when it's in the spore state. For example, enzyme systems. There are some enzymes that even though the calcium salt is there and the water concentration is low, they're unusually stable under this process of denaturization. And so the cell has alternate forms for those enzymes. So when it goes into the spore state, it uses isoenzymes. These are alternate forms of the enzymes. Commonly they'll have a little carbohydrate for one and make them a little more resistant, more insulated to the heat. And so we have isoenzymes that are produced in this one type. So we have four specific things. And another problem we see, or an observation initially that became a problem, was how long these spores survive. As it turns out, although some may claim falsely would believe, that spores can survive thousands of years. So when we find a Neanderthal fellow that's glaciers retreat someplace and melt them away in the Alps, and the Italians find this fellow that's all dried up, and he's several thousand years old, and they find spores, but it's not the spores are 7,000 years, several thousand years old. It's probably a recent contamination. Now recent might be 10 years or 15 years, but not thousands of years. The same thing with mummies that we find in Egypt or Peru and so on. With spores, we don't think the spores are actually as old as the mummy. Okay. But we do think the spores can easily survive tens of years, including maybe even a couple of hundred years. How do they do that? Where do they do that? Well, commonly they're found in the soil. And the spore seems to be able to not suspend an animation kind of thing, but a very, very slow metabolism. So, nothing's going in or out. And it's able to survive for decades, or maybe 100 years or so. How is that possible? Well, maybe it's got lots and lots of ATP. It stores up ATP like crazy, and when
Q4 is full of ATP. ATP is not very good shelf life. So ATP is not the answer. ATP is not the answer. It does not have an exorbitant high amount of ATP. Olympic has lots and lots of glucose, or glycogen, some kind of source of glucose. And the answer was no, it doesn't have that. So how does it do it? They then began analyzing glycolytic feed, one you had memorized in chemistry last night. And an intermediate in that process, known as 3-phosphoglutaric acid, is extremely high concentration, way off the scale. So that's what it does. It takes a partially broken down carbohydrate, glucose. A 3-carbon unit, that they find, is a very stable compound that can stay around for decades or maybe even 100 years or more. So it's sort of like, let's see, you're going to climb Mount Capitan and you and a buddy. And you want to have pancakes at dawn. That was something you thought you'd have to do. So you're sitting around having a beer in the bar nearby and say, let's have pancakes at dawn. And so when the other guy is not up early enough, you get up earlier than they do, and you put in their sack a couple of eggs, a skillet, a quart of milk, some flour, some baking soda, you know, all the stuff you need to make pancakes. Of course, you put it in their backpack that they have to find the table. That's probably not a good idea. But you could take Bisquick. Okay? Bisquick is dehydrated eggs, powdered milk, flour, baking soda, just add water. 3-phosphoglutaric acid is the Bisquick. Okay? It's not yet a pancake, it's not yet ATP, but it's not the raw materials either. It's a much more convenient, long-term storage kind of phenomenon. So, Bisquick, 3-phosphoglutaric acid. Notice on the chart here, it talks about the germination process, you know, becoming a bacterial cell again. And it says favorable conditions. Now, some authors, even people who write textbooks sometimes, get a little carried away at this point. And they say, well, the spores will germinate when conditions are favorable. That's one of those sort of half-truths. Yes, that will occur, it will germinate when conditions are favorable to produce a vegetative cell. But they also germinate when conditions aren't favorable and it produces a vegetative cell that's destroyed. In other words, if you assume that they germinate only when there are favorable conditions, then, to put it in terms of philosophical terms, a teleological argument is made that somehow the spores can predict the future and know that ahead of time that the conditions are going to be favorable and therefore it can start germinating. It doesn't know that. No more than a caterpillar knows how cold the winter is going to be because of the thickness of its coat or something like that. They can't predict the future. So what happens is the spores germinate periodically, and if the conditions are favorable, it will survive and produce a vegetative cell. If the conditions aren't so favorable, then it will produce a vegetative cell that will be directly killed. And we will see spores, because they're so resistant to things, be part of our concern of those fungal infections. There's a common, potentially fatal, always difficult to treat problem associated with nursing homes, rehab centers, even more so than nursing homes, elderly population, particularly the elderly population that has received a heavy dose of antimicrobials. Maybe somebody who broke their hip. So a classic case would be a patient who breaks their hip, they go to the rehab, everything's coming along fine, and they get a Clostridium difficile infection, C. diff. Clostridium difficile. Where did it come from? Spores. Where at? The rehab center. Okay? And that happened a while. If you get familiar enough with that theory, you can smell it down the hallway. It creates a diarrheal problem and can erode away the gut. Can result in a clustering bag on the patient, and can result in death of the patient. It's not a good thing at all. And it's difficult to treat. So, spores in the clinical setting in bad news. So, if we do a little check and we find a common, reasonably harmless clustering, excuse me, Bacillus subtilis organism, then we know that even though that rarely causes any serious, maybe a mild food poisoning, we know that we're not getting rid of spores. And if we're not getting rid of spores, then we got a problem. Any process that results in the sterilization, quote unquote, of the sample that does not kill spores is not sterilization. Sterilization that doesn't kill spores is not sterilization. So spores are our indicator. If spores survive the process, then we have a process that's incomplete. Being a little bit sterile is like being a little bit pregnant, kind of thing. That happens. So if one spore makes it through, then we got a problem. Okay. Give you a little background, just because you will be involved as a member of the health community and providing information to the general public about things. And I'm not telling you enough that you will get arrested and interrogated. But I'll tell you a little bit about weaponization of spores. You may have heard that anthrax has been used as a biological weapon. It's not a very good biological weapon. It's more of a psychological terrorism than it is a biological terrorism, because it's a limited effect. And if you really want a good biological weapon, maybe something like smallpox that infects a high percentage of the population, kills off at least 30% in the process, and it keeps on spreading among a susceptible population. So, no, that's much better. Maybe something like Ebola virus, which people are working on. People do these things. Ebola virus is too good at killing. It kills off so many people, it doesn't spread. Okay. So that's limited use. When it comes to the spores of anthrax, you inhale the spores typically in the biological system, the weapon system, and the spores germinate in your lungs, so the germination process occurs, produces the vegetative cell, and then produces a couple of different toxins that kill you. Okay. Now, for those people involved in that process, one really interesting characteristic for that group of people, they're all mentally a little twisted, I think, but the interesting thing from their point of view is, you know, by the time the symptoms develop, it's already too late to treat. How about that little nuance? Okay? So by the time the symptoms of pulmonary anthrax develop, you're beyond the point of any effective treatment. Prior to that, it's not difficult to treat. So we do it when exposed. There are several antimicrobial agents that work quite effective, and you're not likely to die at all. But if you wait till the symptoms develop, then you've got a much more problematic situation. And how do we recognize the spore? Well, if you look at that spore up there, you see the spore coats and so on, the membrane and so on, it's sort of an irregular kind of structure. And the larger the structure it is, the less spore penetrates into the lung. So a really good spore is one that's really small. So there are machines, readily available, that will be able to grind down the spores so they're really, really small and they're all the same size. So when you look at the microscope of the spores that could potentially could have been a weapon, and if you look at them and they're all nice and small and they're all the same size and nice and regular, that's been weaponized. If they're all the big ones and little ones, they've been not weaponized. So it only takes minutes to determine whether or not we're dealing with something that somebody has tampered with or it's just a natural occurrence. The other thing that people do to make them more effective as a weapon is you can add an agent to it that has a charge to it. So, well, it's not talcum powder, but think of it as talcum powder. So we put talcum powder on it and charge the little guys. So now they're all highly charged, and of course you know that light charges repel. So when you open them up into a room, little tiny things bump off each other, and they stay suspended for days or maybe even weeks. And if somebody turns on the air conditioning or opens a window or a door, they're up again for another couple of days or weeks. So they contaminate buildings for long periods of time, and it's difficult to get rid of them. And obviously, you can't use regular cleaning agents until you get rid of them, because they're spores. So weaponized spores have a different coating on the surface. We've added something to it. they're all a regular size because they've been milled down to a certain size. And what they'll do is that they'll have the person that is in contact with spores inhales them. The spores germinate, causing a pulmonary anthrax problem, and that pulmonary anthrax problem is not infectious to somebody else. It's the spores that are infectious, in a sense. It's the spores that spread, and the person that's got the disease, the pulmonary anthrax, is not making spores. So it doesn't spread from person to person. Again, not a really good biological weapon. But it is a psychological terror aspect to it. So we need to know, in terms of public health, if there's something that happened someplace, the people who are exposed to the spores are the ones at risk. The people who are sick are not at risk. And anyone exposed to the spores can be prophylactically treated, or early stage treatment, depending upon what you call. And we can treat those patients before they develop pulmonary problems, and they'll survive. So once we know we have that kind of issue out there, we can give the proper antimicrobial agents, and the problem doesn't exist anymore. And even the people that got the spores in their lungs, they would be effectively prevented from disease. Okay. So it's not a big weapon, but it is not difficult to make. Obviously, people can make it. Someone's stuck in it on the internet to make it. It's not a complicated thing. But nonetheless, it's something that you may be called upon to talk about in a public setting. So you should know treatable, non-infectious from person to person. Person exposed can be treated and the disease is prevented. And only those patients who are exposed and allow the organism to germinate inside their lungs and are not treated early enough, they're the ones that are going to be at risk for something serious, including death. Any questions about that? So I think we'll be okay with the federal government and not be investigated, but at least know something about what's going on. Bacterial growth curve. Now we can measure bacterial growth in many different ways. We can measure bacterial growth in terms of the amount of protein in test tube of some sort, in a sample. More protein, more organism. The amount of DNA, the concentration of DNA, that is, one's a total amount, the other would be the amount per milliliter or something. The amount of RNA, and so on, many different characteristics. Total number of cells. But what we're looking about here is the number of living cells, so not total, but the number of living cells versus time. And when we do this, we have to find that we have four stages of bacterial growth. Lag, wall, stationary, and death. Each has its own characteristics. And in an idealized kind of curve, it would be across the bottom would be time. I did not put in time because different organisms have different times. The process for Staph aureus, the coli, is divided in 20 minutes, is a lot shorter than something like Mycobacterium tuberculosis or other mycobacterium organisms that divide maybe every 18 to 22 hours. So time across the bottom. And then this is the concentration of organisms. Now the organisms grow so rapidly that we generally do the log of the number of organisms. So if we have hundreds of organisms, it's 2. If we have millions of organisms, it's 6. So we don't bother worrying about whether it's 221 or 1,600,543. Because by the time you've counted that number, it wouldn't be that number. So it's basically, are we dealing with hundreds of organisms, or thousands of organisms, or tens of thousands, and so on. And the number of the organism itself can be clinically important. A urinary tract infection. If we a patient has a urinary tract infection, and we treat them, and they come back with symptoms again. Well, we need to know whether we've got a high number of organisms there again, or maybe there's some other cause, another reason that they have the symptoms again.
maybe we missed the anti-coagulation, maybe the organism of Vermont, or maybe the organism was resistant, there were multiple organisms there, we wiped out some but not all. We can do that. And the number of organisms is going to be what we look at the urine. And take a so-called clean test urine sample, we generally have a couple of hundred organisms in there, maybe a thousand. Because a clean catch is, that's pee in the bottle thing, right? The clean catch is not all that clean, sometimes it's not that good of a catch. But nonetheless, a clean catch sample is going to have some contamination in it, and therefore we expect to find some. The urine itself is probably sterile in most cases, but the process of collecting it, they result in some organisms in there. So the numbers can be worse. If we have a third-year medical student doing a sample on the little old lady in 204 West, and he's still dealing with the modesty thing, and he cleans her up a little bit with surgical soap, and he doesn't rinse her too well, because he doesn't want to look, and she goes in the bottle there, and there's soap in the bottle, and it kills up all the organisms. So now we have a zero. Now, zero is an important number. Zero is probably not the right number. Okay. So we get a zero sample, a urine sample, that number is probably invalid. We have to take a sample again. Nobody has zero. Some, yes. Then we have the other extreme. The nurses take the sample at 6 o'clock in the morning, and they have a new bit, and things happen. It doesn't get around until about 4 o'clock in the afternoon if they realize that sample that they took at 6 o'clock in the morning is still here. And maybe it might have been wintertime sitting next to the heating device, the radiator or something. So now they run into the lab stacked. Okay. After been sitting around for all these hours, they now run stacked. The lab does a test on it, and there's like, you know, hundreds of millions of organisms in there. And the result from the lab is that this person's been dead for a long time, or something's not right. So basically, we have the numbers tell us whether it's a valid sample. Okay. So if we have a few hundred or so, that's normal. If we have, you know, tens of thousands or 100,000, we probably got some degree of infection. So the numbers can be helpful. And again, on that person who's recurring with the symptoms, there's a lot of things that can cause painful urination. Maybe they've got a new coffee machine at the office, and they're drinking a different kind of coffee. Or they got a new Mr. Bumble soap thing, and they got soap in the urethra. And all these things can result in burning sensations. Okay? And it's not an infection at all. So if we take a look at the numbers, that'll tell us whether we're dealing with an infection or not. The numbers can be important. Let's take a look at these numbers. Our first stage, we just take a little bit of the organism and we add it to culture. A drop culture, let's say. And over a short part of the time, nothing is happening. There's no change in the organism numbers. Well, in fact, there's no net change. Because there are organisms dividing and becoming two, but there are also organisms dying and disappearing from the number of viable cells. But the net effect is nothing happens. Okay. So it's a flat line. So there are cells at every stage except at the very end, there. Except at the very end of the curve, there are new cells dividing and cells dying. It's just a ratio of the two that gives us our net effect. So our first line created net effect is no change. But during this period of time, it's a very active period of time for the cell. If the cell does not adapt to the new media, it will die. And what it's doing is determining what's in the media that I need to import, and how do I get it into the cell. Which means it has to go into its genetic information, pull out a piece of messenger RNA, make a protein, and have that as our transport protein, brings in the new carbohydrates that we didn't have before. Okay. So it's got to set up a whole new assembly line with whatever media is producing for us. It's out there. And it's going to have to adapt to that medium. And it just has to go into the DNA and has to activate the sections of the DNA to produce the messenger, produce the protein that becomes whatever we need. And that takes some time to do it. Now, if it doesn't do it fast enough, it dies. So it's sort of an exciting time to itself. Now, if it comes from a very, very rich media, where everything was given to it, and it didn't have to do much in the way of assembly, then this adaption to I've got to do it all myself takes a long time. We call that a step down experiment, or a step down in the nutrient level. So we go from a rich media to a poor media, the period of time of adaption is longer. But if we go from a poor media to a rich media, you went from a medium where you made everything yourself to something that everything is given to you, it's easy to adapt to that. Okay? So if you would hit the state lotto, the mega ball thing for $150 million, say you pay taxes and you still got half of that left, so you got $80 million, you can probably adapt to that. Okay? On the other hand, if you were very, very wealthy, a roommate at grad school was in this category. You're very, very wealthy, and if he was going to Paris, he would probably be living in a penthouse in Chicago. And his helicopter would fly him up the Big Rapids for class. Okay. And he knows people, so he has class only on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, so he's gone. Right. So his helicopter sits around and flies back. And he has a little chauffeur that brings him to the classroom. Guy's waiting outside, taking him to the next class. Limo. Now, this fellow gets a little note from the lawyer that says, "You've just did some genetic testing, and there was a mistake at the hospital, and you no longer belong to us." Have a good life. This guy doesn't know where to get lunch. How do I do that? I never had any money in my pocket because everything was already taken care of. How do I do it now? Okay. So he has to either learn or die. Right? That's what's happening here. Live thing. So, if you're going from a rich media to a poor media, a so-called step-down experiment, that's a longer lag period. If you're going from a poor media to a rich media, a step-up experiment, that's a shorter lag. Once everything is all squared away, we then go to the next phase, and this is called a logarithmic growth, or the log phase, because we're changing the exponent. We're going from 10 to the 2, to 10 to the 4, to 10 to the 6. We're really cranking right along. So this is known as the exponential growth phase, the logarithmic growth phase, or simply the log phase. Because we're changing the numbers of organisms quickly. And we have a steep growth. This is an amazing amount of growth in a relatively short period of time. If this was allowed to continue for 48 hours instead of just a few hours or minutes or so, this was allowed to continue like this for 48 hours. A single cell is estimated to make a mass of cells that weighs several thousand times the weight of the Earth in 48 hours. I'm sure we've been on CNN if it happened last week. So basically, this is a short burst of activity. What slows it down to the next stage, which is stationary phase, is that it runs out of nutrients, where it builds up in waste products. Waste products of fermentation are usually acids. So the pH of the media starts to drop and become more acidic. And you start consuming nutrients, maybe oxygen levels start dropping off. A lot of different things can happen. Now there was a University of Minnesota did some interesting studies on this. Well, I had a bunch of graduate students, microbiology type guys, and he says, for one group, I want you to see how fast you can make them divide. This particular organism, I'm going to give you divides once every 20 minutes. See if you can adjust the growth conditions to make it grow divide faster than that. And they were able to get it to grow in 15 minutes, so 20 minutes. Not any better than that. So they were able to make it divide into 10 minutes. They were able to get it to divide every 5 minutes. Wow, amazing. They went from dividing every 20 minutes to every 5 minutes, just by adjusting the medium. Great job. The other group said, okay, I want you to find out how long it takes to copy the DNA. And they did it, and the cell divided every 20 minutes, it divided the copies of DNA in 10 minutes. And that's called a round-lip replication, or an ROR. And from one end of the circular chromosome all the way to the other end, copy the DNA, start doing that before it doubles, 10 minutes. Okay, now I want you to find out these samples and growth conditions that these other guys use, how long does it take to copy the DNA when the cell divides in 15 minutes, 10 minutes, or 5 minutes. And they came back with 10 minutes. It only takes 10 minutes. It's fixed. So the time that it takes to copy the DNA is fixed. So how is this possible? How can it divide in 5 minutes, one cell, two cells, when it takes 10 minutes to copy the DNA? Now they got a problem. See how the problem developed? They didn't do the little experiments, they wouldn't know what the problem. Well, the answer is called multiple forked replication. There's an assumption when you first heard the problem, didn't make sense, right? First time you heard the problem, there's an assumption that you have to copy the entire piece of genetic information, complete an ORR, before you can start another round of replication. But that's not true. You can start copying a copy right away. And you can be copying the copy of the copy. And copying the copy of the copy of the copy, and so on. So if you start it, it takes 10 minutes. And after 1 minute of this new copy that you're making, you start a copy of that one. So now the first one finishes in 10 minutes. And how long does it take before after that first one is done before the second one is done? 1 minute. This is a minute behind it. So if you look at the concentration of DNA in those cells that are rapidly growing, they've got more DNA per cell than normal. Sometimes, several hundred times, 100% more. Double, triple the amount. Again, sort of like that movement that I had. The reason why he was so wealthy was that their family had this little process. As soon as you were born, they started a fairly large trust fund for you. A couple $100,000, today's dollars. Back then it was only $100,000. So by the time he was 21, he was worth $1 million. By the time he was 25, which most of the way to work, several $1 million. So everybody in the family was a multi-millionaire. Everybody. Even the guy that can't spell his name is a multi-millionaire. So they did not work. Nobody worked in China. Didn't they? They would go to Paris for the weekend for a horse race. You know? They had an island in the Caribbean. They had their own family jet. They owned a county in Minnesota. The whole county. A little railroad track on there. Amazing. But probably there's 3 or 4 years back then. And so, basically, by inheriting all this money, they had everything in the next generation. That's exactly what we're doing here. Okay? The cell inherited all but a little bit, and then it can divide again. So even though an ROR is fixed, it takes 10 minutes, doubling times can be less than an ROR. Doubling times, time to take the double, can be less than round of replication. Seems like it shouldn't be, but it is. Now, we have stationary phase. In the stationary phase, we're sort of in balanced growth. Okay? Balance. In a balanced situation, we have some cells dying, some cells growing. We're back to that. No net change thing again, but we're at a higher level of cells. And the cells are trying to adapt to the smaller amount of nutrients. But ultimately, we go into the next phase, which is the death phase. Now, if we have a cell, once you get to the death phase, or that balance phase or the stationary phase, once we get to the death phase, there are new cells growing all the time, all the way down to the end. So you can rescue this culture just by taking it out. Maybe 99% of them are dead, those are dropping off. But there's still a little bit alive because remember, on the curve are only the ones that are viable. The viability is rapidly profitable. Again, we've built up enough waste products and we have enough deficiency of nutrients that we're not making. That's the death phase. If you look at some definition, doubling time that it takes to double. An organism can double, say, in 20 minutes. Growth rate is the number of doublings per unit of time, usually doublings per hour, so if it's doubled for 20 minutes, it would be 3 doublings per hour. 1 to 2, 2 to 4, 4 to 8, 1 hour. And of course, we've got to go with multiple growth replication. Now, what we just talked about is sort of, okay, microbiology stuff, Why don't we put it into a clinical setting? What, let's say we have an abscess. It's a walled off area, it's a pimple. Okay? But they get bigger, they become boils, they become bigger than that, and so on. We have this walled off area of an abscess. Inside the abscess, what stage of growth do you think the organism is in? Is the pimple massively growing and doubling every 20 minutes? No. Have the organisms been there for a while, so they should be sort of adjusted to what it is? Yes. So what stage is it they're in?
Stationary.
Exactly. Right. The organisms are in a stationary phase. And you, let's say it's staph aureus. So let's say it's susceptible to penicillin. So we slap on a bunch of penicillin on the outside. Is that going to be very effective at that stage? What stage of growth would penicillin be the most effective? Long phase, okay? So just putting on penicillin onto that lesion, onto that abscess, is maybe not the most effective way of treating it. So we drain the abscess. We get rid of some of the mass of organisms. That's always a good thing. I mean, some of these abscesses inside patients' abdominal cavity can be like huge. Basketball size. Okay. And you get, you know, the silver buckets we use in micro labs, and you can catch a bucket of pus from that case. So you open a bucket surgery on you can get a lot. So yes, a pimple is an idea, but you know, expanding the horizons, it could be a lot bigger. So they can be baseball or softball size or basketball size internally. So we drain that abscess, the remaining cells. Are they going to stay at the stationary phase? Because now we have fewer cells, and even though there was not enough nutrients and a lot of buildup of waste products for the mass, now we only have a few people left. People, I think it was people again. Only a few organisms left. And what stage do you think they're going to go to? Log, exactly. So the remaining organisms go to log, and now when we use penicillin, it's absent. Okay? So understanding the mechanism of action of penicillin, it only works on dividing cells. We can modulate the target, the organism, so that it's much more susceptible. Do you know what that works? If we understand how it works, how the drug works, we can make the target organism more susceptible to action. And this is not just simply bacteria stuff. It's any time we're trying to destroy a cell, we can modulate the target and make the drug treatment more effective. Another example, breast cancer. Many, many, many types of chemotherapies are based on destroying rapidly growing cells as opposed to normally growing cells. The basis of selective toxicity is the rapid growth. Okay. So that means that rapidly growing cells in your body, like the lining of your gut and your hair, are adversely affected. So we have vomiting, and nauseous, and diarrhea because the lining of your gut is being affected, and also your hair falls out. So that's the price you pay to zap the tumor. Now, if we have a rapidly growing cell, if we have a breast cancer, there are different kinds of breast cancers, obviously, and there are different kinds of cells, and cells have receptor sites on their surface for different kinds of compounds, and some of these compounds regulate the growth of the cell. And when it becomes a cancer cell, sometimes they keep those. So, for example, breast cancer cell may keep an estrogen cycle. So when estrogen is around, it divides more. So on the first end of the diagnosis, we say, oh, we're taking the estrogen right now until we get this cancer straightened out, okay? Because we don't want to grow any faster. But maybe during the treatment phase, we may give you some estrogen so that the tumor cell starts growing faster, so it's more susceptible to the treatment. Understanding the mechanism of action, we can modulate the target to be more effective by that compound. So it's not just a new bug, it's a basic idea. Question? Good. Bacterial taxonomy. Well, one hand, you got stuff again, and I memorize these things, but there are some things to be gathered about.
The idea of classification is lumping things together. Lumping things together, things that are similar. Family characteristics and things like that. I was at a gathering at my wife's family once, and it was a big house, and there were many different rooms, and people were in different rooms, and they're passing pictures around, and one of my wife's sister had a hobby of taking pictures of people with a fisheye lens. It's sort of like looking through little people in a dorm room or a hotel room, looking at something on the outside. The closer they are, the bigger that part of the body is, you know, the eye or the nose or whatever, and they're looking at people. Well, fisheye lens does the same thing. So we had this. Pictures came in, and of course I knew what the pictures were, but the lady next to me was Italian lady. She's looking at these pictures and she's looking at the big eye, the big nose. She's kind of picked up and she's funny. And then she looks at it and she's really serious. And she says to me in Italian, "Oh my God, a whole family looks that way." Genetic problems. So a family characteristic is something wrong, right? Well, that's what we're characterizing these. Organisms are based on some kind of common characteristic. So the big common characteristic is they're all prokaryotes. And all of that means. Okay? You know, no nuclear membrane, single chromosome, muscle. So they're all prokaryotes. Another name for that is called monera. Then there are two divisions. Easily enough remembered, because division one are photobacteria, that's the blue-green algae. And they're not of particular medical importance. They are the ones that are sensitive to light that make ATP that way, of course. Then we have all the other bacteria. And SCOTO means indifferent. So division two are indifferent to light. They don't care whether light's on or not because they're not using light to get ATP. So those are the two divisions, with or without light. And then we have classes. Division two has three classes. The first class is most of the bacteria. 95%. And it says EU. We used that term before. What did EU mean? True. So EU eukaryotic, true karyotes. True nucleus. This is true bacteria. You can think of them as being complete bacteria. They got everything they need. Okay? There's nothing different about them in major ways. Then we have class two. There's something different about them. They're obligate intracellular. They must live inside of our cells. Their problem is that they can't produce enough ATP to meet their needs. They're energy parasites. Obligate intracellular. Energy parasites. Now they do produce some ATP, but not sufficient levels for them to survive. And the actual technical problem that Rickettsia has is slightly different than the problem that chlamydia has. The bottom line is the same, they can't produce sufficient levels of ATP. Now, Rickettsia, a funny name, named after a guy named Rickett, go figure, right? Rickettsia. These are organisms that live in an intermediate host that's usually an arthropod. For example, one that we might see in the United States on occasion is Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever. Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, the reservoir is in a tick, wood tick. And so we typically see this associated with someone who is horseback riding or walking in the woods a lot. And as they go through the woods on their horseback or walking and so on, they get wood tick then injects them with the organism, the Rickettsia organism, that causes Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever. Another very notable, historically important Rickettsia organism is Rickettsia polachecki, or the organism that causes typhus. Typhus, not typhoid fever. That's a problem associated with a food poisoning kind of invasion of the GI tract. But typhus spread by a Rickettsia organism, Rickettsia polachecki, that invade the body louse. And so conditions in which we have lice, body lice, not head lice, body lice, such as during wars, refugee camps, that kind of thing, where personal hygiene and sanitation is not very good. Then we have typhus. The typhus can kill you, okay? The
history, there's a fellow by the name of Zinsser who wrote a book called Rat's Lice in History, and he went into great detail of specific campaigns during the Crusades, that basically what would happen is, this happened lots of different times, the Crusaders would surround some village or castle or anything, and they'd do a siege. They'd block the food from getting in and out. And the people on the inside would have their own food stores and their own water, and they would wait them out. And if the conditions were right, which they often were, these armies outside, which might number 100,000 on the outside of the city, after a few months, there may be 7,000 left. Devastated with all the typhus. Right? So the typhus has changed the course of history repeatedly. Of course, these were the groups of people that developed biological warfare, too. When you're out inside the siege, the people aren't going to give up right away. They take bodies of the people and they send them in by catapults into the city and infect them. Bugs have been used for warfare on all sides. So rickettsia, typhus, and Rocky Mountain spotted fever are examples of these organisms. A friend of mine was up traveling west. He was in Utah, and he saw a sign of National Rickettsial Labs. He went, wow, this is neat. I didn't know this. So he turned off the express lane, he drove down some dirt roads, took him a half an hour, and he finally got to this building. And he went inside, and there was the receptionist and like hundreds of pigeons, people, eight by ten blocks of open. And she says, I'm sorry, we don't allow any visitors to the lab. It's all highly endangered unit and so on. So you can't come in. And so, oh, I guess, you know, that's what it is. And she says, by the way, I didn't know there were all these rickettsial famous people. And who are these people? And she says, oh, these are the people that have died in the facility in the last 20 years. See, they have to infect the arthropods and sometimes they get loose. Not a good idea. Okay. And so then they pitch in and you get the study. And we would give you different things that we were talking about. If I was giving this lecture in Southeast Asia, we would talk about Tutumoguchi fever. Okay? Tutumoguchi fever is a big problem there. So there's, depending upon the insects that they invade, the range of the disease is different. And the reason I bring that to your attention is that whatever the cause of the change in the temperature, you can argue global warming and CO2, or you can argue with just normal things, no, but whatever is changing the temperature, we do know that we now have different climate zones, and they are changing. We can grow wine in the UK where we couldn't grow it before, things like that. So things are changing. And one of the things that's changing is the organisms in the tropics are moving up into the subtropics, and the organisms in the subtropics are moving up into the temperate zone. And so these organisms that are dependent upon other life forms are having an expanded area. Which they can cause infection. So we are seeing some interesting changes that way. So rickettsial organisms require an insect, an arthropod, and they are limited to causing the problem wherever that arthropod is found. Chlamydia, another organism that is an intracellular, probably an intracellular organism, again has ATP problems, steals from the host cell. This organism causes trachoma, which is an eye infection, and trachoma. As we see the infection in the United States, it causes a gritty kind of conjunctivitis, like sand in your eye, and you go to the doctor and we can treat it. Okay? And it's not an unusually rare situation at all. And chlamydia is also, in the United States, is also a sexually transmitted disease. And of course, depending upon your sexual activity, the sexual infection and the eye infection could be related. Okay? And so we have, can be. For a while we did a study on campus. We had people in the health center, when someone came down with a chlamydia infection, they also did an eye swab. And people over in the optometry clinic, when they had an eye infection, they sent to the health clinic to get a cervical smear or urethral smear. And we statistically find a great degree of correlation there that you might expect it might happen. Chlamydia is an extremely common STD. It's usually undiagnosed. It doesn't have a lot of symptoms to it. It's a main problem with human infertility. And just remember the bugs seem to interfere with the sperm and egg coming together. So it's basically a treat for the tumor. But basically, sperminism is extremely common. The estimates are someplace between 50 million or more people in the United States. So there's a lot of people with this. Some estimates go as high as 100 million. So it's extremely common, STD. So chlamydia in the United States is a treatable problem with an eye infection or an STD. Around the world, it doesn't get treated really rapidly. So in Africa and Asia and other parts of the world, India, what we see is this really kind of conjunctivitis that's sort of uncomfortable. What happens is that you result in what's called a cobblestone kind of change in the epithelial cells. And as you blink, it scratches the cornea and you go blind. And so what will happen is that this is one of the leading causes of microbial blindness in the world, trachoma. And it's just simply not treated early enough, commonly. We don't see trachoma in the United States because, again, people go and get help if they've got this painful kind of rigidness in their eye. The third category, again, remember the EU with the true eyes, and we have the first class two of the ones that are obligated to cellular. And now we have ones without cell walls, and that's mycoplasma. And little note there, mycoplasma is not a protoplast. Okay? You know, protoplast is a laboratory artifact or something. Naming of things, we should know a little bit about the naming. Again, it's one hand, two cup stuff, but we're not in the book, we didn't even know the detail of it. Online, and book. Genus and species, we underline them unless you write in italics, and you cannot write in italics, but you can type them. Capitalized genus, not the species. These are just little things that are important not for your communication to patients, but your communication with other medical professionals. So you're sort of sloppy in this, but you don't know what you're talking about. Family endings, we saw one already, Enterobacteriaceae, we were in E. coli early on. E. coli, Salmonella, Shigella. That family ending is the ACEAE, so it's a suffix, and we saw Enterobacteriaceae pronounced AC, even though it's spelled ACEAE. An order ending is ALES, ALES. And we could have one with, say, Pseudomonas, we mentioned Pseudomonas. Pseudomonales is the order name. So just be a little bit familiar with it. Obviously nothing to memorize, but be familiar with it. Let's start a discussion about viruses. We're going to consider a virus a life form. It has characteristics of other life forms. It has nucleic acid, for example. Genomic nucleic acid, and it can control its own replication. I want you to go online, though, to learn about something else. And then you will know the difference between these two things. I want you to tell me the difference between a virus and a prion. Prion, the proteinaceous infectious particle. Prions are associated with a kind of disease known as Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, CJ, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. It's also known, another problem with this prions is something that's called bovine spongiform encephalitis. Bovine spongiform encephalitis, also known as mad cow disease. And you'll learn a little bit, if you do a good job, a little bit about amyloid proteins. And if you do a little more study, you'll recognize that there may be some similarities between these problems and Alzheimer's disease, which of course we don't understand completely. Now, I'm not saying that Alzheimer's disease is caused by prions, but there are some similarities in terms of amyloid proteins, that sort of stuff. So take a look at that and be prepared to distinguish between prions and viruses. Why are they not all together? And some important diseases associated with prions like you just mentioned. Okay. So viruses are alive, a life form. They are small, but size is not an important characteristic to separate them from bacteria. Because some of the larger viruses in the pox family of viruses, pox viruses, like smallpox and cowpox and monkeypox and so on, the pox viruses are actually larger than the smaller bacterial forms, which would be mycoplasma and rickettsia and chlamydia. So mycoplasma, rickettsia, and chlamydia are in the range of bacteria are on the small end, and the pox viruses are on the upper end of viruses in their size range, and they actually overlap. So viruses can be larger than some bacteria, or you know, bacteria are smaller than some virus. So size itself is not the definitive characteristic. So you can't say, well, it's a small stuff. Yeah, so are some bacteria. The genomic nucleic acid. Now, you said that it has genomic nucleic acid, but the types of genomic nucleic acid make it different. Types of nucleic acid make it different. For example, you have double-stranded DNA. Plants have double-stranded DNA. Bacteria have double-stranded DNA. Zebras have double-stranded. Everybody has double-stranded DNA as their only genomic material, except viruses. Viruses may have double-stranded DNA, or they may have single-stranded DNA as their genomic material. In fact, they may have double-stranded RNA, or even single-stranded RNA as their genomic material. They have four possible forms. Now, a given virus has only one. One of those four. But as a group, they show diversity that no other life form does. And remember this idea of differences in the development of drugs? If the virus is a double-stranded DNA virus, then that's another strike in favor of being similar to us and make it harder to treat. If the virus is a single-stranded RNA virus, we open up some possibilities. What about single and double-stranded as well? What's the advantage or disadvantages of double-strandedness and single-strandedness? What happens if you have a double-stranded DNA like your cell, and you have some UV damage, you're sitting in front of the sun rays too much, or maybe you're laying in a tanning bed or something, and it's messing up your video cell DNA. It causes thymidine dimers and things like that. So, screws it up. How do we deal with that? What if one strand of DNA is broken? We can use the other strand as a template. They're complementary base pairs. So whether there's a D, there's a T, there's a T and an A, and so on. Right? So because they're complementary base pairs, one codes the information to the other. So if you have double-stranded, you have to conserve genomic information. Mistakes are easier to correct. Less variety, which could be a good thing. Okay? Otherwise, you get people with big noses and big eyes and what. If you have a single-stranded life form, like a single-stranded RNA virus, for example, and you have a mistake on one side, you don't have a second side. So you're going to have a lot of changes there that you can't correct. And they can either be lethal changes or they can be just changes that make you different. For example, HIV, human immunodeficiency virus, is a single-stranded RNA virus. And during the course of infection of the patient, there are thousands of different mutations that occur. It's not the same thing all the time. It's constantly changing. Now, that makes a problem. We're trying to develop vaccine against it, what's conserved? Because you've got to make a vaccine against something that's going to be in all very lifeless. And if it's constantly changing, then that's a problem. And what we've done so far, we found a few areas that don't change much, but that doesn't seem to result in protection. So we can't develop, at this point in time, a vaccine. So single-strandedness and double-strandedness has an impact on the likelihood of changes being permanent or not. And a double-stranded organism is a much more conserved kind of genetic information, less change. Single-stranded, more likely changes occur. Examples of organisms, viruses, that have capsules and that are not encapsulated, let's say envelopes or no envelopes. The envelopes are not really capsules like bacterial cells. The envelopes are lipid layers. So we have a lipid layer, and it can be a DNA genome or an RNA genome. It can be, in these cases, we have single-stranded DNA and double-stranded DNA. So notice how it's listed there? Here we have parvovirus. Puppies sometimes get a bloody diarrhea. We have a vaccine for that, veterinary medicine. Parvovirus is an example. That's an example of one of the parvovirus genes. Here we have single-stranded DNA. We have double-stranded DNA. Adenovirus is a double-stranded DNA. That causes eye infections and respiratory tract infections. Arenovirus, the virus is an invading insect. So we have, again, double-stranded DNA. And they don't have any envelope on them. And then we have the envelope viruses, the double-stranded virus here. This is the virus here. Another virus, this is the pox virus. You can see they're very big. So cowpox, monkeypox, double-stranded DNA virus. Here we have a herpes virus, herpes simplex, that kind of thing. And that's a double-stranded DNA virus. So we can start categorizing on whether or not they have an envelope or not, and whether they're DNA or RNA, single or double-stranded. Next time we'll talk more about the classification of RNA.